She's to sick bay. The doctor should look at it as soon as possible.
It is the way in which we propagate our species. Please demonstrate how this is accomplished.
So, what's next?
I don't know.
Hi, welcome to Casual Trek, a Star Trek recap and ranking podcast. Brought to you by Nerd and Tie and the Dutch language. Take that, Lovecraft! I'm Charlie Atheridge Nunn, a writer and Event Horizon fan.
I'm Mars Reed Lobato, a science fiction writer and a space battleship Yamato fan. It has very little to do with the topic of discussion, but it will crop up later.
Ooh, foreshadowing. I like it. So, each episode, we watch stories from three different Star Trek shows and rank them on a big list of best to worst. We both love Star Trek, but as it's far from our first fandom, that makes us the ultimate objective voices on such a task. And this episode, we're looking at a subject which is near and dear to my heart. It's some cosmic horror. And yeah, we didn't even make a sentence before I mentioned Lovecraft with that. Let's, you know, see if we can not do that again. But before we go on, Miles, what non-Star Trek thing have you been enjoying since we last spoke?
I feel at first I need to plug yet another guest appearance on Breakfast in the Ruins, where I am talking with Andy, the host, to Michael Moorcock's a foray into IP writing with the 11th Doctor Who novel, The Coming of the Terrifiles. And Charlie, we've had some digressions on our show.
So I've given up at this point from going, I think this will be a short one.
And so that, you know, I think we spend about an hour and a half of an hour and 45 minute episode just talking about Doctor Who, and then talk about the first two chapters of The Coming of the Terrifiles in the last 15 minutes before realizing, yeah, this is definitely going to be a two-parter. We'll have to get back to this.
It was an impressive listen. It did make me wonder, are you going to start all over again in the second part and do all of the kind of intro stuff and do like another two chapters by the end of it?
We'll have to see. It's going to be recorded in like next few weeks. But the non-Star Trek thing I have been enjoying has been the first two episodes of the new Star Wars Disney Plus exclusive TV prestige drama show, Star Wars The Acolyte.
Yeah.
Which is set 100 years before the prequels and takes place in what is known as the High Republic era, which has been part of like the an ongoing series of books, YA books and comics set in this kind of era of the Republic when the Jedi are very much at their peak, before the kind of collapse into how they appear in the prequels and prior to them getting wiped out by Revenge of the Sith. So this is back when the Jedi were the peace and guardians of the Republic. All that stuff Obi-Wan Kenobi talks about so glowingly. And it's a lot of fun. It's a murder mystery. It's very much inspired. It very much takes some Hong Kong wirework wuxia martial arts style fights. It even has Carrie Ann Moss, who plays Trinity in the Matrix films, as a Jedi. And yeah, although if you listen to various areas of YouTube or Twitter, because there have been no white men in the show, that means it's a moral failure of a TV series.
I mean, there are a lot of white men in the other Star Wars. It's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've liked what I've seen so far. It feels like, even though the Jedi look very prequel in kind of presentation, and like, oh yeah, nothing changed apart from, you know, morally and socially they were a bit shitter as it went on. The world's nicely grimy, and the Force feels odd. You know, it feels strange at times. And that's what I like in a kind of weird space magic system. As much as I loved, you know, the Star Wars D20 system back in the day, the varied RPGs have been on it, and the video games like Jedi Knight, it just treated the Force like simple stat boosts, little feats, plug-in abilities.
I think we've actually said on this podcast that the big problem with the Force, because of the games and both video and role-playing, I think in a lot of people's minds, the Force is basically like Super Saiyan-style power levels.
Hmm. Yeah.
And not just like this weird mixture of, you know, Buddhism and other whatever George Lucas was paying attention to at the time, just stuck in a blender. And so I liked the martial art. I liked the very martial arts fights. Like, they were nice to see. The one Jedi who was cut himself off from the world and is like in a meditative trance, but he's surrounded by like a force bubble, so all this one character's attacks can't get through. I liked that. And yeah, and also the fact that it's not connected to the main films is really refreshing, because I feel like out of the Star Wars prestige TV show for television we've had, honestly, out of the ones not called Andor, I feel the Obi-Wan Kenobi show was the best, because it knew what it did, it was fun, it got in, it got out, and yeah. The Mandalorian, I feel, kind of, as enjoyable as it's been at times, kind of disappeared up its own lore ass. And that's the word lore and the word ass separately. I'm not just misspelling the Lorax. And Book of Boba Fett exists.
Yeah, I started off enjoying it, and I felt increasingly disappointed the more it became like Mandalorian 2.5.
Yeah.
And I think that was our kind of our quitting point with being invested in Mandalorian. Because as much as we got, I don't know, we got maybe halfway through season 3, but Emma didn't watch Book of Boba Fett. Like, she'll do a Star Wars thing. And yeah, it just going back to it, it's like, oh, we've missed stuff.
Yeah.
Do we care? As it turns out, not openly. No.
And thanks to Ahsoka, I am now slowly rewatching all of Doctor Who, because I just needed television that sparked joy in me.
Mm.
And that's really all I could say about Ahsoka, is it was unfortunately just kind of flat. And I feel kind of annoyed that the sequel to a very popular series of cartoons for some reason has to be live action to be seen as like legitimate drama, and not the fact that like Lucasfilm and Dave Filoni have been doing stellar work with the Clone Wars cartoon and the Rebels cartoon and the Bad Batch to go, no, you can do proper drama in a CG cartoon, but nope, we got to do a live action Rebels for whatever reason.
So yeah, as someone that's seen maybe 8 episodes of Rebels and didn't continue, I just didn't watch Ahsoka, because I was like, I'm going to need to have known, or, you know, it won't be as effective.
No, you need to have done the reading. Ugh. Which again makes it an odd choice for a live action show to do in a spin-off. I mean, okay, you had Ahsoka and Boba Fett, not Boba Fett. You had Ahsoka in The Mandalorian, but it's not like the Ahsoka show is not doing its own thing. It's just sequeling off the stuff that Rebels ended on.
Yeah.
So yeah, what about you? What was your non-Star Trek thing this week?
Well, I've been finding something in that kind of British light entertainment comedy-ish slot in my life, because Taskmaster's ended, or at least the current series of it. And I've started watching something featuring two previous contestants called Hold the Front Page, starring Josh Widdicombe and Nish Kumar, as people that are trying to go from town to town, taking part in the local press. And they desperately want to get a front page story, and sometimes just getting a story is difficult enough for them. The level of competence between them is almost at the level of one human person, maybe an adult. They do get sworn at by a number of their showbiz friends when they try and use those ties to kind of get a potential story, ending up shouting at Stephen Mangan, who was judging an art show, for not giving them an interview. But they did come in 30 seconds before the end of it. So, it was very good fun. Fairly light, fairly daft. And the variety in places that they covered was quite good as well. Going from, you know, like a big town of paper that likes to run itself as if it's a national one, to a couple that have run out of people's homes.
Okay.
So yeah, it was good fun. It was far too short, being a couple of series of five, six episodes. So yeah, we ended up beasting that in the last fortnight.
Okay.
Huh. Mm.
Sky Original. Okay, interesting. I have to find out, see if I can.
Yeah, I've no idea what it's on over there. But yeah, if you want some light chuckles, and to laugh at beautiful incompetence.
Josh Widdicombe?
Yeah, yeah. As it turns out, he pretty much doesn't want to do anything and is always kind of horrified and upset at it all, while Nish Kumar is, well, proving that it wasn't an act, being as incompetent as he was in Taskmaster.
Okay.
Because there were debates on, was this a bit? Was he intentionally being this bad? No.
Oh, so it's like Rishi Sunak in the current prime ministerial elections.
Oh, topical.
Oh my god.
It's all doomed.
Just when I think the bottom of the barrel can't be scraped, Rishi skips out of the 80th anniversary of the D-Day landings early to do an interview. Was it he went back to do an interview about why he left early, or did he do an interview to campaign some more?
It was a campaign thing that he'd
left. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my god. Just like,
and that's the thing, like, we're hitting that point where we do have, like, there's a series of posters around Brighton with just, we are swimming in shit. So yes, welcome to our past decade plus. So yeah, what fun.
Can I ask a quick question? As a Brit who immigrated out 13 years into the 14-year uncontested reign of unmatched Tory power, has the only thing they've actually accomplished is that the passports are blue now?
Yes.
Okay.
Also, they've been very good at opposing their own people, but you know. It's not like we really get a say in any of that.
Yeah. It's always irritating when I've had Americans go, you know, I bet it's not this crazy back home. And it's like, no, it's in some ways, it's this fucked in its own way.
Yeah, it's weirder.
Think, yeah. The fact that, like, the general people have not had a, because of how how it's done, we don't get a say in the leadership of the country. It's down to a bunch of idiots in Parliament.
Well, from one horror to another, we ought to talk about cosmic horror in Star Trek. And there was a lot more cosmic horror in this universe than I originally thought. You know,
yeah.
Even having seen, you know, a solid maybe 50%, maybe a little over, of Star Trek's offerings before when I grew up, I wasn't as big a horror fan back then as I am now. And
no,
I don't think it clicked that, you know, yes, you've got these wonderful, weird spaceships and swashbuckling in space and exploring things, but sometimes a ship is just obliterated by some weird cosmic entity, whether it's a living, knowing one or not.
Like, honestly, the show that felt the as a kid, the Star Trek show that felt the weirdest and kind of most frightening, was actually Star Trek the Animated Series.
Hmm.
But I don't know if it's just because of the limited animation and the fact that we see a lot of shots of the Enterprise alone in space, and my weird childhood just kind of phobia of disturbing faces just made me think that show was more frightening than it actually was. Or actually wow. is. But then the first episode of the animated series, Beyond the Farthest Star, we have a malevolent cosmic entity which is inhabiting a dead spaceship.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. They're not all intentionally malevolent, as we're about to see, but yeah, there's a lot of weird shit out there in space.
So for people listening to this right now who aren't aware of cosmic horror, Charlie, can you sum up in 30 words or less the basic tenets of cosmic horror? We didn't plan this beforehand.
Yeah. Space is far too big and terrifying. We are oh so very, very, very tiny. And there are nasty things out there. There we go. There's for less.
All right. Was that 23 or 24?
I don't know. I can't count.
Okay. I'm going to go with 24. So hooray.
Hooray.
Hooray. You won a prize. The prize is you get to tell us what our first episode of the episode is. So yes, you have won What You Do Anyway.
Oh.
It's an election year.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay.
And remember, we're British.
Oh, so, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh. Anyway, our first episode of the evening is Star Trek The Original Series, Season 2, Episode 19, titled The Immunity Syndrome. It aired on the 19th of January, 1968, written by Robert Dabaroff and directed by Joseph Pevney, directing Trek for the last time.
So is that Robert Davros?
Dabaroff.
Dabaroff, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was...
Davros was busy doing other stuff.
Are you sure you didn't accidentally say Bobby Davro?
I mean, autocorrect loves to change these names on me, so it could have been Bobby Davro.
Oh, man, that's a deep British cut there.
Yeah, and the UK and US number one hit was the same thing. It was the Beatles with Hello, Goodbye, which, you know, there's better songs for theirs. You know, I think even Lennon wasn't the most impressed by this.
Is this our first Beatles song of the show?
I thought there were others. So I'm pretty sure we had a talk about, you know, being a Beatles or a Stones person.
Oh yeah.
Eleanor Rigby. Oh. Be a couple of times. And Hello Goodbye again with For Trouble with Tribbles.
Oh yeah. Well,
joint.
Okay.
Yeah, they got about, as it turns out, back then.
It turns out those Beatles were very popular. Alright.
I'm going to be recapping the journeys of an intrepid space amoeba and the tiny things that get in its way.
All right, Charlie, as always, you have 5 minutes to study the giant space amoeba.
Ooh.
And engage.
So, the Enterprise has been working for way too long and everyone's knackered. Kirk is both dreaming of R&R and objectifying a nameless member of a crew at the same time. Who says he can't multitask? They intercept a message about the Intrepid, a ship with 400 Vulcans on it, and Spock recoils, feeling 400 souls very logically being snuffed out. It's not just that, though. The entirety of the Gamma 7A system is suddenly lifeless. Billions of people have died. Oh my god. Bones checks out Spock, and he didn't realize Vulcan telepathy works at that kind of range. And Spock pulls it, well, you don't know everything about us. And also, those Vulcans didn't know everything about what was going on when they died. They were confused by it all. Meanwhile, up on the bridge, there's a weird dark blob floating in space up ahead, like a hole, almost. It's coming from where the Intrepid and System Gamma 7A were, and heading towards them. The Enterprise launches a probe, and there's a weird noise, making everyone grab their heads and shake about in pain, and then it's gone. Some of the crew faint, and it hit worse than others, and the sickbay's got a massive queue, as everyone's nervous, weak, and irritable, kind of like my last few years. Kirk snaps at Spock when he can't define this thing in space, and suggests using reverse logic to figure out what it isn't. I don't believe that's reverse logic, but sure, we'll go with it. Kirk then stumbles.
Hang on. I'm just going to do some reverse logic. Beep, beep, beep. This logic is reversing.
Thank you.
Beep, beep.
Anyway, as they get close to the zone where this absence of space is, there's another weird noise, and then the stars have all gone. Oh no, Scotty calls in that they've lost 5% of their power. Don't know where it's gone. Under the sofa? Maybe. But probably not this time. Bones starts shooting everyone up with stims, but even so, a red shirt who looks weirdly like a young Hugh Dennis passes out. Spock says that the energy is in opposition to them. The stronger it gets, the weaker they get. And Bones reckons they should bail. Kirk then passively aggressively announces to the entire crew that the mission will go on. The ship shakes, and reversing from the blob doesn't appear to be doing anything. And Spock suggests the illogical move of steering towards it. Kirk's a petty bitch, taking him up on the offer, if only to nag him if it all goes wrong. There's a big meeting, and Kirk asks Scotty for one big push. They're running out of energy, but sure, why not do that? It's time for the big push, and everyone leans back, shakes around in the most Star Trek ship shaking that I've seen, and nothing comes of it. Looking outside, there's now a giant space amoeba, all glowy and weird. It's 11,000 miles by, at points, 2,000 to 3,000 miles. It's mostly goo, and it is alive, drawing them towards it. They decide to send someone in to take readings and see what can be done. Spock and Bones argue over who's the best for it. Who should sacrifice themselves bravely, slash, is Kirk's special boy. So Kirk, of course, decides to send Spock. And McCoy can't even bring himself to wish Spock luck until he's got in a shuttle and is out of earshot. Spock penetrates the amoeba and heads towards the nucleus. Apparently, it has enough energy to reproduce, and that's bad because they're not having any luck dealing with one of them. Spock is suffering in the ship and says it's all sensitive under the membrane, and then guilts Bones for not wishing him luck earlier. The Enterprise needs to get in and needs to destroy it. Bones compares the amoeba to a disease, and that's it! Kirk has an idea. They can be the antibodies, because, you know, we can get away with murdering this, as it's basically a space disease. Shields up. Let's get sucked into the amoeba. They go all shaky again, and an extra falls over the railing, but not in the direction you'd think he would. Kind of goes up and over backwards. They send a probe with antimatter into the nucleus, and Spock records a final message for the crew back home, as does Kirk. They bump into the shuttle and pick it up after firing the probe and detonating it. Spock... Oh! Ooh. Detonation! Oh, dear.
All right.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay, almost there. Go. Home stretch. So, Spock protests about being rescued, and Bones tells him to shut up, because he cares about Spock, but is still going to give him shit. The power levels are down, there's a shake, and then space is back! The organism's dead, the ship's fine, Spock's fine, and now they really need some R&R. Kirk makes one last HR violation, and they head to a starbase.
Okay, so quick question.
Yeah.
How many seconds did you think I burnt up with that reverse logic bit?
I don't know, 4 or 5?
Should we say 10?
Why not? Why not?
Okay, so given that, I'm going to say that you were 19 seconds over.
Ooh, okay. So, yeah, I didn't say with the HR violation that, let's face it, the Enterprise has no HR. Otherwise, a lot of things would be different there. But yeah, this was for a show where they were all just on the ship. They had a lot of extras. They had a lot of people roaming around with it. And a lot of kind of, oh my God, oh, I'm so sleepy. You know, it felt like me in the afternoon now that I've vastly decreased my coffee intake and begin to drift off.
Do you know who wasn't in the episode this week?
Oh.
Sulu.
Oh.
Which is a shame because the entire bridge crew gets special citations and commendations. Except for Sulu, who's being played by some bloke named Kyle.
Yes. Yeah, what was it? Lieutenant Kyle, who, yeah. Yeah, also, when I was looking up for cast, one of the stuntmen was called Dick Dial, which is a very odd dial. And it also puts him up there with brilliant names of stunting dicks, like Dick Warlock.
I think I've been to Dick Dial somewhere in Kemp Town.
Oh my God. Yeah, what a name.
What a name.
Yeah, so the Space Amoeba was fun and weird, and it felt fairly unspoken, the kind of, we can't just kill a space thing.
Yeah.
But they were, like, Kirk seemed overjoyed when it was put together that, wait a second, this is a single-cell organism. This is basically a disease. So we're stopping disease, and no one likes disease, right? We're not murdering some new life form.
We're not killing an amoeba. We're killing a way of life.
Yeah. I mean, admittedly, the amoeba did kill billions of people.
Yeah.
And an entire solar system. So it's not a good amoeba by any means. But, you know.
I mean, I guess, like, giant floating space amoebas just aren't a common occurrence in Star Trek. Because you think it'd be happening more often, or maybe it just does, and they just kind of work around it.
Well, yeah, space is big. Like, we're not going to be there for every giant space amoeba sighting.
Probably gets to the point where it's like, giant space amoeba? Yeah, it's Tuesday.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't know if it's just that I've not seen many episodes where we see engineering, but seeing the grills and behind it, everyone, like, climbing up and down little ladders and doing things there. It's like, oh, that's quite a nice little background that they've got. Hopefully it's a nice cheap day's work for the extras. Just hop up and down the ladders a few times while Scott is talking and leave it at that.
Right, just climb up this ladder. You climb up the ladder. You press the buttons in no particular order.
Hmm. Exactly. This is also apparently the last time we see the inside of a shuttle.
Oh, okay.
I don't remember seeing the inside of a shuttle in the original series.
We saw it in Menagerie.
Ah, oh, yes.
Yeah.
Where they were tracing, yeah.
Yeah, okay. And then I remember there's that one episode from the first season when Spock, McCoy, and a couple of extras get marooned on a planet via shuttlecraft, and they have to kind of get their way out.
Ah. Yeah, I mean, that said, ever since we started the show, there's one episode of the original series that I've seen that wasn't for this. Every other original series episode I've seen for this now. So it's all new territory for me. And I was initially worried watching the remaster. I think I messaged you going, I think this blob's more exciting in the original one, because I just saw the black, like, outline.
Yeah.
Blob. And luckily, when they got closer, when they got inside the big space of nothing, there was a weird psychedelic kind of cell thing shifting and moving around. So yeah, originally it was just a couple of bits of liquid pressed between thin glass. And I've seen still images. I was like, yeah, some nice,
yes, give us
psychedelic looking kind of things.
Give us the weird shit.
Yes, exactly. And this was a bit of a weird shit, but also at the same time, it's difficult making a whole lot of nothing interesting. You know,
yeah.
We had that last episode with Stormy Weather, where the kind of, okay, it's a whole lot of nothing, but also everything's disintegrating, kind of like, you know, a Langoliers sort of situation. Here, everyone's just getting a bit tired.
Yeah.
And it loses some drama for the tiredness, even though all the Amoeba stuff is still good fun.
You wish that you got more like the crew size at loopy, because the fact is McCoy's just walking around just going, and you get drugs, and you get drugs, and you get drugs.
He was right on it. Like, they must have so many things ready to go, right? Okay, do we need uppers or downers for the crew? Everyone's too hype. Come on, get
the reason why there's no HR on the Enterprise is because the quarters allocated to the HR department were requisitioned for Bones's drug collection.
Of course, that stash, you know, needs to be looked after properly. Needs to be in the right environment.
So, question for you: Do you think this is the most Spock/Bones episode?
I mean, it is entirely that thing of, you can see fans going, oh, they both resent each other, but they love each other so much. Oh, there's like, yeah, there's definitely a bit more of that than with Kirk and Spock here, because, you know, they're with them both fighting to be Kirk's special boy and go out and potentially sacrifice themselves in a shuttlecraft. And oh god, like, Spock's a bit petty as
Spock
well,
is
going,
a...
oh, I got shook up, a human wouldn't have survived that. Bones.
Spock is in full petty bitch mode this week.
Yeah, and it's fun to see, but then you got other things going on, Spock.
But then again, he did just feel 400 Vulcans just snuff it, so he's having a rough day.
Yeah, that must be a bit weird. And he mentioned a whole thing about Vulcans have never been conquered. They've got no idea of, you know, suffering or subjugation or any of these kind of things. It's like, well, Enterprise will prove that wrong, I'm pretty sure. And as will, you know, most of the shows after this, but there has been stuff. They didn't just appear all pious.
Yeah.
Hell, their background is all kind of, yes, we were, you know, pretty savage and pretty brutal until we learned to rein it in.
Killing. We love killing.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe he was just given, you know, that kind of the history lessons.
He's like
the American school system level of going, you know, we just happened to arrive here and everything was fine.
He's giving the British educational system's history of the British slave trade, which is, we formed a slave trade, but only so we could abolish it a few hundred years later.
Yeah, we gave it back. We gave everything back.
A few
mostly.
Centuries later.
Yeah, there is that. So yeah, I'm assuming it's basically that as my kind of no prize to Spock saying
that.
Much like the Vulcans never lie, which is bullshit.
Yeah.
which is the kind of thing that they all quietly agreed to say to anyone. To go, look, if we tell all of them, we just need a united front, Vulcans don't lie. And look, then they'll believe anything we say.
Look, I'll be honest, I have used the all British people are naturally sarcastic and rude to not get fired so many times at work.
Oh, good.
So, like, I have played that card. I played the Vulcans don't lie card, except, oh, yeah, all British people are inherently snarky. Eventually, they'll meet a second British person and realize I might be full of shit.
God, I thought you were going to go with something more outlandish. You know, like, all British people lay eggs or something.
No, but we do have two dicks.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, how is your second penis going doing, Charlie?
About the same as the first.
Yeah,
you know, it's all right.
I mean, my one's taken up jogging.
Ah, nice. Is that going to cause one to be an entirely different shape from the other after too much exercise?
Oh no! See, the other one has taken up bench pressing.
Okay. Wow. Good to hear they're both keeping
good,
out.
Good to know. We're like Klingons in that way.
Or allegedly Nightcrawler.
Yeah. Oh no, it could be worse. We could be like the Centauri from Babylon 5, who canonically have like a collection of tentacles, and that's their genitalia.
Wow, I'd forgotten about that.
Yep.
Yeah, so, serious drama, Babylon 5.
that's okay. At least we're not going to bring up the fact that Time Lords don't have sex and instead reproduce using looms.
Looms?
Looms. It's a novel thing. It's a thing created by the novels in the 90s because apparently, despite all the extra sex and violence in the Doctor Who novels, the idea that William Hartnell's doctor may have had a granddaughter by the regular way was a bridge too far for Doctor Who fandom to cross. So it's like, oh no, Time Lords don't have sex. They were all cursed to sterility by this space god, and so they reproduce using these giant machines called looms. And for the audience at home, Charlie is face-palming like Patrick Stewart in his meme-tastic prime.
I mean, I knew the Star Wars novels had a lot of weird shit. But that's new. I assume that's something that got memory hold, as far as any other Doctor Who things. Or, you know, is it something that's been referred to a lot and I just didn't notice?
Who knows? Do you want to put this in the big list?
Yeah, so our big list currently stands at 111 entries. Our number one remains Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. Our 50th entry is DS9's The Forsaken, where Loxana Troi and Odo have an intimate scene in a lift. Number 100 is Discoverers Despite Yourself with Captain Killy. And finally, right down at the bottom, we have in place 111, Lift Us Where Suffering Cannot Reach from Strange New Worlds, where they just let the child killing machine keep doing its thing, because why not? This did make me think quite a bit of Stormy Weather that we covered last episode with the big amount of nothing. And that's currently in place number 68. I think Stormy Weather might be a bit better. Like, it's a bit busier, definitely. But yeah, that terror of everything getting langoliered away was interesting to see. And certainly more interesting than everyone getting sleepy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
like, this does have, like, that huge, fantastic image of the Enterprise and the giant amoeba. But it just, I don't know, it just doesn't really... Like, there are some really good bits, and then there is kind of, like, I feel it picks up in the second half, but it does kind of drag a bit to get there.
Yes. Yeah, that, I think, years ago when I first heard they were remastering Star Trek, the original series, I was like, are they shortening some of it? Because my vague memory of an episode was that it took a long time to get anywhere. And, yeah, this one... Yeah, pretty much goes along there. Let's see. I'm just skimming down from Stormy Weather at 68. Like, we've got What Are Little Girls Made Of in 76, where the answer is robots.
Robots.
Robots. They're robots. Mystery solved, everyone. I don't know, like, you were mentioning Beyond the Farthest Star, the animated series' pilot, which is down at the bottom of that clump in 88. I don't know. I kind of think maybe Beyond the Farthest Star is a bit better. The cosmic entity, the cosmic horror is alive and malevolent, and you get some brilliantly weird spaceship scenes in that kind of you couldn't do this in live action sort of thing. So even if the animation's like, you know.
Yeah, I feel like Beyond the Farthest Star does more in 22 minutes. And it's like, it's fine. Like, it's fun, but, you know, as... Like, I feel in some ways this is, like, the quintessential, like, mid sort of Star Trek episode.
Yeah.
Like, if not for TOS, but we're going to have so many... Next Generation, so many Voyager episodes, where is we encounter something weird in space.
Yeah, which, admittedly, we invited that by going cosmic horror, but, you know, yeah, it still fits for remit here.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, it's not as good as Move Along Home
no.
in 89. What about The Impossible Box?
I feel that this is better.
Then that puts it at spot number 90 on the list. Now, this is still, you know, it's still a mostly positive list. You know, you have to get real far down before you start getting to the utter trash. So even though it's down here, it's not the lowest original series. And yeah, it's all right. It's just, yeah. I think possibly the least exciting of tonight's offerings.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, we've got to go on to our second episode.
All right.
Episode 2 is Star Trek The Next Generation, Season 2, Episode 2, Where Silence Has Lease. This aired on the 28th of November 1988. Written by Jack B. Sowards and directed by, should have checked for pronunciation, but Winrich Kobe, I think.
Yeah, I think that's correct.
The UK number one hit was Robin Beck with First Time, which looked like the music video felt like it was set in the same kind of places where like Celine Dion and Meatloaf were flouncing around singing about lost loves and that you see on any of those montage adverts for CDs like rock hits of the 80s. It was fairly generic. And Bon Jovi with Bad Medicine, one of the ones I know the least of his work, of his hits.
Yeah, it's not like the iconic Bon Jovi song, but like it's always nice to hear a power ballad. It's a form of music I wish would come back for a while.
Yeah, I'm not a massive power ballad guy, but, you know, one or two. Just a treat is quite nice.
Like, you know, they're not around as much, so I want to see more of it.
Yeah, this one isn't on Rock Band, basically, so I didn't know it as much as the others. The video had them giving cameras out to a bunch of people to film a live show. And, yeah, it was a bit of a mess, a bit chaotic, but not in a bad way with all that. So, yeah, and I believe this time you're being cast into the cosmic beyond to speak with weird faces in space.
All right, I'm ready.
Speak into the void.
We open in a jungle. Riker's looking pretty haggard, and then he's approached by a pig-faced guy and a Skeletor dude. Worf jumps out and gets into a fight, killing them both, and using a metallic spiked glove. Unfortunately, Worf's a little bit too into it and starts to look menacingly at Riker. Turns out it's actually one of Worf's exercise programs, and Riker was very much amazed that Worf does this every day. And Worf's like, yeah, this is like the beginning level. And they got some downtime while on a surveillance mission. Then they discover with Wesley at the controls, this will be important later, a zone of pure blackness in space. Is this the moral and ethical center of the Tory party, thus creating a black void? Quite possibly. Any probes they launch into it disappear. And as they study further, the zone grows, enveloping the Enterprise, leaving them in a black void with just nothing around. Picard orders Wesley to turn us around and get us the hell out of here. But as Wesley tries his best, they find that like they're now just basically going in circles. They don't know where they are. They can only escape. Sorry, they cannot escape.
Oh, yeah. It'd be easier if they could.
It would be a much shorter episode if they could. They drop a probe and just drive away, but then the probe appears right in front of them. Oh, great. They're in a backrooms video. And then suddenly, a Romulan warbird just decloaks, and immediately Enterprise is like, right, fire! They blow it up. Picard's like, this is a bit too easy, and Geordi is loving having just, committed an act of war. Then suddenly, they detect another ship. It's called the Yamato. Is it a World War II Japanese battleship reconfigured to be a space battleship? A space battleship Yamato, if you will. No. It's actually another galaxy-class ship. It's actually the Enterprise's sister ship, the USS Yamato, which appears to be completely abandoned. Riker and Worf beam over, but every time they kind of explore, they keep ending up in the bridge. Worf quickly starts freaking the hell out because, like, clearly the map is glitching. Then the Enterprise notices a hole opening in the void, revealing space outside. Wesley's on break, and this grumpy guy has taken his place. Is this important? Maybe. They try to get Riker and Worf to get beamed back on, but every time they try and save Riker and Worf, the hole in the void starts closing. And so they give up trying to escape to get Worf and Riker back. This keeps happening two or three times, and Riker realizes that we're being manipulated here. We're not playing. We're going to stop this. This is getting us nowhere. And then, in the void, a face appears. A face in space. It is the void. It is a creature that calls itself Nagilum. And it's very curious about humanity and humanity's, what it sees as its limited existence. And wants to see, he basically wants to just kind of see how these humans react to different circumstances and pressure. So Ensign Haskell, who was covering Wesley's break while he went off to get some lunch, starts screaming and convulsing and then drops dead. Nagilum was like, oh, okay, you can die. This is interesting. I am going to kill a third of your crew just to see what I can do with this. And Picard's like, nuh-uh. We're not going to let a ton of us die to satisfy your experimental whims. I'm going to blow up the damn ship instead. Picard and Riker set a 20-minute timer on the self-destruct mechanism to give everyone a chance to, say goodbye to their families, crank one out, whatever. Picard is in his quarters listening to some calming mood music, and then Troy and Commander Data walk in, both going, hey, why are we blowing up the ship, Jean-Luc? What is death like, Jean-Luc? I'm scared of dying, Jean-Luc. And Picard realizes, nope, you're fakes. This is a trap. You're actually Nagilim trying to make me not want to blow up the ship. And the doppelgangers disappear.
Oh, as do those 5 minutes. Oh my. Right. And continue.
As the countdown nears zero, suddenly the void has vanished and the Enterprise is seemingly back in normal space. Picard tells them to pick a direction and just book it, just in case. Wesley, who's now off break and back piloting the ship, convenient, poor Haskell, zooms the ship off in any direction, and Picard, with seconds to spare, cancels the self-destruct mechanism. They've been freed from the void. In his ready room, Picard is met by the face of Nagilim on one of his computers, and Nagilim believes that the species is flawed and has nothing in common with Nagilim's own kind, and Picard disagrees, saying, hey, both of us show a curiosity to what we consider the unknown, so there is a connection between our vastly different forms of life. And Nagilim has to accept the logic of Picard's statement before vanishing, never to be seen again.
That's a minute and three over. And yeah, Picard, it feels like, must have been biting his tongue not to say, yes, we both express curiosity, you know, some through murdering and all that. Do you reckon that anyone who takes that position from Wesley is going to die?
I would like to hope not, because that would mean that leaves that job position open.
Yeah. Yeah, Haskell must have been feeling like, why me? Why me? Not the
like,
child?
We have a ton of people just kind of working those back computers. Like, it doesn't help that he's black, and thus he suffers the horror movie rule of non-white guy dies first. But the fact that you have Wesley there for the first quarter, you have Wesley there for the sec for like the last quarter, like the last quarter, and Haskell is there for like 10 minutes, at which point he just kind of clutches his head and dies. It's a really blatant, okay.
It's a rough one.
It's a rough one.
Yeah, it was a fun episode. I found myself cringing way more than I thought when Data called Picard Jean-Luc. And it's like, okay, between the way that Picard feels like he would get his family to call him Picard, and Data being so very formal, this should never happen.
Yeah, this is weird.
Yeah.
See,
yeah.
Okay, just think about what they could have done is had Haskell be the helm officer for like the first half, and then have it be Wesley who comes in asking Picard about death.
Yeah.
And then it wouldn't just feel so weird.
Hmm.
But I liked how they made the corridors and sets of the Enterprise, which they use double duty for the Amato, to be all, and I hate to use this word because it gets used far too much and far too incorrectly, liminal.
Ooh. Yeah, it's difficult when you've got a bottle episode like this, and like the director sounded like he didn't like the like just using the bridge set and stuff because it was kind of boring. So actually trying to do some things with the direction to make it look unsettling, to make it look like, okay, yeah, you are, again, you're in a big space of nothing. This does seem to keep happening. So how do we make this interesting? How do we make, you know, the Yamato, which, let's face it, you know, as you say, it is just reusing the same set, slightly different lighting. How can you make that terrifying? And for someone like Worf, who is very much a linear thinker, with these kind of things, his freak out, you know.
Worf is definitely I would say he's a materialist. In that, I think, I mean, hopefully using that term correctly, in that he accepts what is real right in front of him. Like, yeah, I feel like Worf would get really distracted if Riker held up a sheet and then pretended to disappear when the sheet falls down. I think Worf would just kind of have like a freak out.
Or at least just a moment where it's like, oh my God, what just happened there? Yeah, that kind of object permanence thing. But yeah,
I liked the bit when Worf stepped through a door from the bridge into the bridge. It kind of reminds me of those parts in the Portal games when you can where you put the portal in such a spot where you can see yourself about to walk through the portal.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, Portal was so good.
Portal 2 is one of my favorite games of all time.
Yeah, it's one it'd be nice to go back to at some point. Did you know who Nagilam was?
I did not. I assumed he was just a big green face.
So, first of all, Nagilam is Mulligan backwards, which was the surname of Richard Mulligan, who was going to play Nagilam.
Okay.
Instead, they got Earl Bowen, a.k.a. Dr. Silberman from the Terminator films.
Oh!
Yeah.
Oh!
And that guy from the Monkey Island.
Wow.
I didn't realize Dr. Silberman was also LeChuck, and I definitely didn't recognize him in this. But yeah, there's a guy who did a lot of work. Like, he passed last year, but he was definitely an actor who got work. And it's fascinating seeing, like, this is him.
It's always lovely to see, like, character actor types from like the 70s and 80s just turn up in Star Trek. Like, we had Dick Miller, fantastic supporting character, who was also in The Terminator. He played the gun shop owner.
Yeah.
As a newspaper.
The Dixon Hill one.
Yeah.
Yes.
But no, I have to say this. Space Battleship Yamato is like a 1972 Japanese anime. Mm-hmm. It's a space opera where in the far future, Earth takes the wreck of a World War II battleship from Japan's navy, turn it into a spaceship, which still looks like a Japanese battleship, and proceed to go on an adventure across the galaxy to reach a planet, to get a thing, to get a gadget, to bring it back to Earth, to cleanse it of the radiation, which has been, because the planet's been irradiated by the bad guys of the show. Right. It was an attempt to create like a science fiction anime, which appealed to like more teenage audiences and have like much more serious subject matter. Leiji Matsumoto, who passed last year, who is one of the greats of Japanese science fiction manga, worked on the designs. It's like one of, if you watch enough anime, you see its fingerprints on a lot of shows because it's influenced so many people in that genre. It was brought into the West as Star Blazers post Star Wars, and the people who worked on Star Trek Next Generation are gigantic weebs because this will not be the last anime reference we get in Star Trek The Next Generation.
Oh. Okay. Yeah, so that's interesting to hear with the Yamato. I was wondering why they picked that name.
Yeah. At some point, you get two ships named the Key and the Yuri after the two main characters in the Dirty Pair.
Yeah.
At the same time, in an episode of the original Dirty Pair anime, on a computer screen, the names of the original cast of Star Trek flash up.
Ah, nice. Nice to hear that it goes both ways.
It goes both ways.
I say that, reading Excalibur and seeing Chris Claremont reference for Dirty Pair in one of the Crosstime Caper issues and going, it feels weird. Like, I would expect Claremont to reference, you know, old school science fiction and fantasy authors, but he is a being who exists in time. So, of course, of course, he of all people would know who the Dirty Pair are. And similarly, his references to Buffy, which then, of course, took great influence from the X-Men. Like, Whedon always said Buffy had a lot of Kitty Pryde in her, and of course the surname Summers and all that. So watching these weird loops of referentiality,
it's always weird, because just I don't know, it's always something I'm very fascinated by, because I also know that a lot of the 60s and 70s mecha designers who will go on to work on shows like Gundam and Battle of the Planets were heavily influenced by the Gerry Anderson shows such as Thunderbirds and Stingray and Captain Scarlet.
Cool.
And like, it's just always that, it's always fun just kind of seeing where the threads of influence. So like in Evangelion, when you have like the city being able to sink underground when it gets attacked, I'm like, that's a Stingray reference.
Yeah, but very, very Anderson.
But, you know, the thing is, try not to be like an earnest Klein about it, because then I'll have to deserve a kicking.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Nagilum.
Yeah.
In terms of cosmic horror, this is definitely more than unlike the Amoeba, which just feels like it's just doing its own thing, Nagilum very much feels like more personable than most cosmic horror entities are, but still just as incidentally malevolent.
Yeah, there was what was it in Voyager, there was a malevolent entity that was doing these kind of shenanigans. That's it, persistence of vision, and it felt almost like that, of the kind of, you have these space entities that are so big and weird, and like, yeah, in theory, their morality is entirely different to us because they're cosmic. But also, they're arseholes. Like, this guy, arsehole. That one in Persistence of Vision, arsehole again. And yeah, it's how you deal with this thing that is vastly more powerful than you. Which, you know, a recurrent theme of Roddenberry's work of, you know, the crew come up against God, the crew beat God. But in this case, it's almost more like a child pulling the wings off of insects.
Yeah.
Especially when he's like, oh shit, you guys die. That's interesting. I've not experienced that before. Let's see how it goes.
It's almost like the wormhole aliens, in which they don't understand how life can exist in a linear space. And Nagilum doesn't seem to understand how life can be finite.
Yeah. Yeah, well, the wormhole aliens took that message in a kind of, oh, this is fascinating. Okay, we're cool with this. This is interesting compared to, the Nagilum, who's like, oh, I've got plans. Like, you won't like them, but I've got them.
It's like, do you think Nagilum is evil and cruel, or do you just think he's just so... The difference of scale is just so much that he can't see the Enterprise crew as being creatures with their own agency.
Yeah, I think it is that kind of cosmic amorality. You know, when you get your elder gods in kind of mythos things, it tends to be like they do not even know we exist. If they did, they could snuff us out in an instant if the whim took them, but they are beyond us. And at this point, sadly for the Enterprise, they drew the attention of something of that kind of scale.
And then, you know,
less weird and tentacly.
That face is very unsettling, and a kind of... it reminded me of some of the creatures you get in the old show Nightmare. Where it just looks like a cheap chroma key. It just looks like a cheap chroma key effect on like very primitive computer graphics.
Yeah, I didn't see anything about how that effect was created, but yeah, definite Nightmare vibes. You know, you can imagine him coming out of a wall or anything like that. Or, you know, you've walked into a field, there's space, and this face coming out of it.
Like, I can imagine if you watched this at the right age, this would be traumatizing.
Yeah. Yeah. Who was it? I'm sure I spoke to someone that said that face freaked them out when they were younger. Because this was one of those ones that had been repeated enough and seen enough. Like, I have seen it multiple times despite my limited experience with the entire, you know, output of Star Trek. So yeah, I'm sure that face has been in a lot of children's nightmares.
So this is a Dr. Pulaski episode. Pulaski. And do you just feel they intentionally wrote her to be the worst?
I don't know. It's that thing of, I wonder if there was an attempt at recapturing any grouchiness that Bones has.
I think that was like the intention, but it never comes off as I swear, for the most part, yeah, it never comes off as charming, because, you know, Spock always seems to, you know, gives it back in kind.
Yeah,
like they have, yeah, the back and forth.
Nice here.
Meanwhile, Data's just like, you know, he's being insulted by Pulaski, and he's just like, I don't have emotions. I don't really care.
Mm.
And yeah, it just doesn't.
That just makes her worse, I think, with it.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's the kind of thing where I'm pretty sure later on in the season, you kind of experience her enough to go, fine, you're there. You're not great, but, you know, that at least is a character trait. You know, being a bit pugnacious, a bit kind of like, a bit stubborn and occasionally dickish. It's fine. That's, you know, let characters be dicks. I'm a fan of Damian Wayne. He's an arsehole.
Yeah.
I like Quentin Quire. He's an arsehole. You know, she's not quite in full arsehole territory, but yeah, she's more abrasive than we're used to with this crew.
Yeah. And I think that's just why she doesn't feel like she fits in. You know?
Yeah, well, I get her frustration of, like, I arrive and this happens. And it's like,
yep.
Mate, you're on a flagship.
Any other place,
it happened once, twice in several years. Enterprise. This place, every day, every week.
You're in Star Trek. Expect weirdness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just please you're not on, like, a blown-up starbase or something.
Yeah, just be glad you're not on a ship which is crewed entirely by Vulcans.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. It turns out it's a rough week for those
in this episode. Selection. So, yes. Where does the Gilliam and his big old face go on the big list?
So, I think, 58 is where we've got persistence of vision with the hallucinations from the space jerk. And while that's fun, I feel there is a kind of iconic feeling to this episode. You know, it's one that, again, it's in that cultural memory. The fact I can't even remember the name of the antagonist of Persistence of Vision is a bit of a sign.
Yeah.
You know, as fun as the hallucinations were.
Number 53, Captain's Holiday.
See, I like it. I like a heist. I like folks getting in scrapes like that. I think this one might be a bit more, you know, again, a bit more iconic, a bit more of a Star Trek.
A bit more of a Unica threat. This is like our heroes discover something nasty in space and deal with it in the best way they can.
Yeah,
threatening to kill themselves.
Yeah, yeah. They're not playing his game.
No.
Yeah, also, the thing I noticed with that, Riker needed to be there to be the second person confirming the blowing up. On Voyager, Janeway doesn't have a second person. Like, it's all on her. Like, she don't care.
I think, like, the computer knows, like, when to do drama.
Yeah. Cool. So that would be
alternatively, just like, maybe Janeway just didn't trust Chakotay, and just Janeway forgot to give Chakotay second in command privileges over the self-destruct mechanism because of his Maquis background.
Oh my god, how many years in to their voyage was it before she realized she'd not given him passwords to anything as second class?
I don't know. I feel like that's probably like a call to HR, but guess what? They're in the Delta Quadrant and there's no HR.
Ha!
So it's just like they have to wait till like they get home, and that's when he can finally get the slip of paper with the passwords. He finally gets the keys to the vending machine on his last day of the ship.
Oh, that'd be great.
I think that's already established in Star Trek that HR doesn't exist on these ships.
Yeah. Yeah. So that would put this at the new 53.
Yep.
So, episode 3 in our trilogy of cosmic horrors. Our trio, I guess. It's not really a trilogy.
No, a triad.
Yeah, our triad of terror.
Like, it's a thematic trilogy, like John Carpenter or like Edgar Wright.
Yeah, yeah. They've listened to the show, probably. Yeah. They get it. Anyway, it's Enterprise, Season 3, Episode 5, Impulse. Now, I like Mark Waid. I like Humberto Ramos. Of course, I'm going to be a fan of Bart Allen, a.k.a. Impulse, the most ADHD-riddled speedster in all of DC Comics. This is not that, though. Instead, this aired on the 8th of October, 2003. Teleplay by Jonathan Fernandez. Story by Jonathan Fernandez and Terry Metalis of Picard fame. And directed by David Livingston. Yeah. Yeah, it was one of those, oh, I know this person. I've seen his things. It's filled with nostalgia. Speaking of which, the UK number one hit was The Black Eyed Peas with Where Is The Love.
Of course it was.
Yeah, yeah, that persisted for a while here. And yeah, it feels so 2003.
At least it's not Coldplay.
True, true. And like, yeah. You know,
like, the kind of post 9/11 maudlin, it's either this or Coldplay.
Like, as far as Black Eyed Peas goes, right, there were some good songs originally. Like their first album, surprisingly good, especially if you've mostly heard what came after Where Is The Love. Even Will.i.am's debut album, surprisingly actually all right. And then he became the Black Eyed Peas' Will.i.am.
Oh dear.
Which, yeah. And the US had Beyonce with Sean Paul and Baby Boy, which feels like, again, Sean Paul feels like the most 2003 artist to have featuring on your music. That and Beyonce probably wouldn't be caught dead bothering with anything like this anymore.
No.
Mm. Yeah, it's a weird one where you go, oh yeah, actually the Black Eyed Peas song is almost a strong contender with the tracks we've had. We've experienced this week. You know, Beatles aside, but that's, you know,
the Beatles.
The Beatles of the Beatles. It's kind of a separate thing.
All right. So are you ready to talk about Vulcan zombies for 5 minutes?
Wow. Way to jump to the point there. Yeah, yeah.
All right. Well, you know, it's Enterprise. It's a point where we're doing the not good cover of the theme tune.
Oh my god, it's so much worse than the normal one. Like, which is still bad.
Well, I disagree with you there, but the normal, like, the original one has, like, you know, again, I feel like this is the post 9/11 zeitgeist of, oh, we can't feel joy anymore. Everything has to be in a minor lower key, so we have to be more like Mad World. Like, that song was everywhere. But have you ever listened to, like, the Tears for Fears version from the 80s? Now, that song, that version fucking slaps. Like, definitely much more punkier, definitely much more new wave, much more fun music video with some really fun, kind of awkward dancing in the background, which was definitely my moves in the nightclub of roundabout. But, you know, God, oh no. Do you want to be worse?
Mm-hmm.
The Enterprise theme sung in the style of the Donnie Darko cover of Mad World.
Oh, for some reason my mind went to Cotton Eye Joe, but yeah, yours is worse. Anyway, I've got 5 minutes, or this zombie virus will take over.
Eh, you're a Marvel fan. What have you got? What have you got to lose?
Wow. Okay.
And go.
So we start in media res. Archer's carrying T'Pol to sick bay as she screams and attacks him before she's tranquilized and put in a tube. One day earlier. Trip and Archer are fretting about his indie mission late at night. Trip wants some R&R, maybe a film night. He invites T'Pol, who kind of brushes off a lot of this. Hoshi interrupts the awkwardness with a distress call she's intercepted from Vasileia. It entered the expanse 9 months ago and then went silent. They're in the expanse and it's doing their kind of space war and terror thing. Anyway, this bit of it is filled with trillium-rich asteroids. Reed, Archer, T'Pol, and some rando called Hawkins. Yeah, he actually had a name, apparently. Shuttle round the asteroids looking for Vasileia. T'Pol says she worked there before going to Earth. Meanwhile, back on the Enterprise, Trip and Mayweather beam some trillium on board, and it works. They beam a bigger amount and it gets stuck in the walls. Oops. Time to get in Shuttle Pod 2 and hack some out themselves, do a bit of, you know, Minecraft stuff. Meanwhile, Shuttle Pod 1 finds Vasileia. There are biosigns, but no one's responding to hails. They get on board, and it's a wreck. Pretty much the opposite of how orderly you would expect a Vulcan ship to be. There's sparking, there's flashing lights, there's Vulcan blood, and someone's banging in the distance. Then, a crazed Vulcan attacks. He looks like a zombie. He's got all green and stuff on his face. The gang phase him, and Archer asks T'Pol if she's all right. She lies blatantly and says yes. Reed and Hawkins also get attacked and just about fight through the Vulcan zombies. Hawkins wants to kill them but is told no. The crew members clamber up and away trying to call the Enterprise but they get nothing. They need to travel up 4 whole floors to get some good reception, all while Vulcan zombies give chase. Trip and Mayweather, however, they're having a fine old time. They're blinged out in their nice gold spacesuits. They have a rough landing on the asteroid, but, you know, Trip's into that. Meanwhile, on Vasileia, the gang knock out a Vulcan zombie and check him out. Archer asks T'Pol what's up, and she knew this Vulcan, who doesn't say hello. He just screams at her. He claws at T'Pol, and she's already feeling a bit freaked out by all this, especially because whatever's happened to him is happening to her too. Oh no! Yeah! Hawkins asks, how could Vulcans be angry and screamy? They don't feel emotions. And T'Pol points out they do. They just control the emotions. It's a different thing. Apart from with these zombies. These zombies, all just emotion, all just rage. Reed and Archer sneak about, find more Vulcans and punch their way through them. Trip and Mayweather get some trillium from that asteroid and fly off before another asteroid hits them. They're safe, but the motor's totaled. It's going to be a few hours to get it back online. Archer and co. Safe-ish where they are, apart from T'Pol, who's beginning to lose her nerve and snaps at Archer. He calls the Enterprise. Now they're near enough to get good reception, and they have to survive for a couple of hours to allow for Shuttle Pod 2 to get repairs. That's going to be tough. T'Pol is yelling at Archer, saying he's trying to sabotage her work. She hates all that he hates all Vulcans as revenge for holding humankind back. Meanwhile, Phlox has discovered what's causing this problem. It's the trillium. The Enterprise's version at synthesizing it is almost like homeopathic level. So it's so diluted it won't affect T'Pol. Here, it's all pure. And it's what's driving everyone crazy. The other Vulcans, they're kind of dead already, just moving around. T'Pol might survive if they get her out soon. Outside of all this, the infected Vulcans are attacking the door. The ship's blowing up all over the place. An Archer has to carry to pull over a narrow pole over a massive drop. Very video game quick time event looking kind of thing. She fights back, so he stuns her and carries her over. They get to Shuttlepod 1 and it's still clamped in. Shuttlepod 2 shows up just in time to shoot them free. Back at the Enterprise, T'Pol's inoculated and recovering. She asks to be left behind at the next stop, and no, Archer won't do that. It's film night. Phlox and Trip loudly talk about the movie, and she tells him to keep shtum.
Oh, so close, so close.
Oh. But I will not keep shtum. Oh no, I'll keep talking.
Keep talking.
Good. So yeah, she leaves for film night and sees moving objects, moving things around, and it's Vulcan zombies. One of them attacks her. Oh no, they're here on the ship. But no, it's just a dream. She's still recovering. She's still all ill and a bit sweaty from it all. The end.
26 seconds.
Yeah, this is a thing that apparently will keep going for a little bit.
I think we saw the repercussions of this in Home.
Yeah.
Where
Arch got told off for killing all them Vulcans.
Yep.
And it kind of, they were a bit far gone anyway, so.
Yeah. So it's nice to know, and we now know in hindsight, that Archer did the best he could and not just like, blow him up.
Yeah. Yeah, not like what the feverish T'Pol thought.
Or Trip in Strange New World.
Oh, yes. Yeah. That actually felt like T'Pol's outburst felt like Trip's one from there.
I'm surprised we're not keeping account of every time a character in Enterprise goes crazy and racist.
Yeah, hopefully it won't be too many times, but, you know, we've had, what, 3 or 4, I think, so far. Vulcan zombies, definitely an interesting choice of thing to make into zombies.
I feel like they're the Vulcan, they're like rage zombies from 28 Days Later.
Yeah. And they seem to use tools a bit. You know, not much, because I guess the thing is, they're not zombies. They're completely emotionally all over the place. They're kind of berserk and feral, but they're still Vulcans.
Let's just do what they do in 28 Days Later, because they don't want to say the word zombie. It's silly. They're infected.
The infected. Yeah. Although it felt like the crew had a bit better a chance than you'd expect, given how tough Vulcans are.
Mm.
You know, when Archer flings T'Pol at one point and then stuns her, it's like, should he be able to do that? You know, like, Vulcans are pretty tough, generally. So, yeah. But it was an alright thing. I enjoyed the cosmic horrorness for first two enough. Seeing the rage zombies, I was like, it's a little bit of a letdown, but it's fine.
Yeah. Like, they're driven mad by the environment.
Yeah.
And I felt that kind of worked. It's not like it was a mutation or they got infected by it's like they got infected by the fact that there's so much weird shit in space that you don't know what the side effects are going to be.
Yeah,
in that kind of Annihilation.
Yeah. Oh, I love Annihilation. Yeah, it's that kind of thing, which, again, goes into the cosmic horror of this. Sometimes you just go into a bit of space that's wrong.
Yeah.
And for most species, Trillium's fine. For Vulcans, all my no. And, yeah, now we know with that. Which, we've not seen much of them in the Zindi Expanse, but it felt very isolated here.
Yeah.
You know, going, oh yeah, this Vulcan ship that got pulled in here and 9 months passed and no one said anything. And yeah, now it's fucked.
I like the there are bits in the episode I like. I like the opening where you have Archer and Trip. talking about how the crew is on edge, and Trip's like, hey, let's do movie night. And Archer's like, nope, we have to be grumpy about the Zin. We have to be grumpy about space war and terror. We can't have fun because that means the terrorists win.
Yeah, that was entirely Archer's vibe there. Well, Trip was definitely appreciated. I do like that after watching Broken Bow and going like, you kind of got two of the same person here. They are distinguishing themselves as separate entities a lot more.
So are we in like the Dark Archer arc, or Darcher, if you will?
Darcher. Maybe. Like, it's what, about a season's amount of time before home where he'll be told to get over it. So I hope that they don't make, you know, make him have to go through just a whole season of being miserable.
I wonder if we'll see him commit a war crime in the name of fighting the space war on terror.
Yeah, I'm expecting some space waterboarding at some point.
Had New Battlestar started yet?
I want to say no, but I genuinely don't even know anymore.
So 2003.
It was 2004.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, my word. Actually, December 8th, 2003 to October 27th, 2009.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, right. So yeah. It's a couple months away from this. The cold open felt like another show, especially the one day earlier. Alias used to do that almost for level of parody by the end of a cold open, and then 48 hours earlier.
I feel like that entire thing is now just parodied, you know, is now just seen as like a parody cliche. You know, you have like the vinyl scratch freeze frame. Yes, that's me. I'm sure you're wondering how I got into the situation when it all started with some bad Trillium.
Well, also, with this, it's after the credits we get a little more time, and then one day earlier. Like, the cold open here, at the time, it was the shortest one, and it definitely felt that. I assume Short Treks has probably taken that.
But, yeah.
It was jarring, but not in an entirely, like, unappreciated.
No, it's just, you know, Star Trek, it's like we said with In the Flesh. Very rarely does Star Trek not adhere to, like, a very kind of 1-2-3 mode of storytelling.
Yeah.
So we were pretty surprised in the Flesh, where it starts off right in the middle of our heroes investigating something weird.
Mm.
And then here, where it's basically, yep, we're just going to have a flashback to what happened. So you sort of, oh no, what's happened to, she'll be fine. There'll be some storyline stuff.
Yeah.
I was surprised that the Marine guy, because they have Marines, because they have the Makos. I'm thought he was going to die, but also I know that Enterprise, it very much intentionally tried not to be so cavalier with killing people off because of just the nature of them being the first deep space mission.
Yeah, I've been trying to get better at actually knowing people's names. So I had a look at the cast list, and I think he appears in 4 episodes in total.
Okay.
I haven't seen if he meets a grisly end.
No.
So, you know, maybe that's a treat for a future episode.
But, like, but, yeah, it's, we've seen worse Enterprise.
Oh, definitely.
Definitely. But we've also seen better.
Yeah, I was just skimming through the list and seeing a bunch and going, oh yeah, that Enterprise episode was actually pretty good.
I don't know, I feel like from my memory, anytime Enterprise or Voyager tries to kind of go all action or try and do like Aliens, where they're running up and down corridors and Jeffrey tubes with phaser rifles, it always just kind of feels awkward, because Star Trek is generally not that show.
Yeah. Yeah, it's that odd thing of trying to be like TV shows of that era. Again, Alias coming to mind, which normally it's any spy show that I see, any vaguely modern spy show will be compared positively and negatively to Alias at times.
And not good,
but it is very aughts.
And not 24?
No. No, 24's too war on terror for that, you know? It's too much, like, let's brutalize some people and then literally have Kiefer Sutherland as Kiefer Sutherland at the start of an episode going, look, I know we've said a lot of things, but not all Muslims are evil. And immediately then go to the episode and it is, you know, like, yeah, just all Muslims are obviously evil. Oh, it's kind of thing. It's like, guys, this is, even for the era, this is rough.
Yeah. Like, I don't know. It feels like 24 had like the bigger zeitgeist than Alias.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it definitely did. But for me, Alias was the superior show.
Okay, so what was better? Alias or Lost?
How dare you? How dare you make me choose?
They're both noted J.J. Abrams joints.
They are. I love spy shit, especially if it can get a bit wacky with it, which is why I like Alias. And the season 2, like, ripping the plaster off of all of the shit, one of the best, like, getting the whole show and flipping it over.
Have you ever watched The Avengers?
Bits.
Because I feel like for wacky spy shit, you really should be watching like the Peel and the Seed and Peel era of The Avengers. Yeah.
But yeah, but at the same time, like Lost has a lot of the weird bullshit and a lot of the ensemble cast things.
So,
Yeah, I don't know. I think it might win out ever so slightly, but Alias always has a fun place.
We need to stop discussing Lost on the podcast because you and I both know where this will inevitably end, and neither of us want to put our partners through that.
No, definitely not. I've had a strict line drawn, and it is specifically Lost.
Okay, so what do you think Emma would break up with if you started watching first, Blake 7 or Lost?
Oh, there have been threats with both. But yeah, anyway, on to this. Speaking of which, yeah, we need to get scoring this, as we need dinner to be happening. As it's and lunch morning be for happening. You, it's evening for
me. Well, it's now early afternoon for me. Okay, so I see you're looking at number 61, the Andorian incident.
It's no Andorian incident.
It's not. It's got.
I love the Andorian incident.
You know what? You want to say, okay, do you know how you can improve any episode of Voyager? 30 minutes in, a door opens, and Jeffrey Coombs just walks in.
Of Enterprise, you mean?
Of Enterprise.
But also that.
Hell, any TV show. 15 minutes into an episode of EastEnders, like, Jeffrey Coombs walks into the Vic.
That'd be great. Door slams open at the end, and then doof, 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 doof.
Yeah, I just kind of want, like, Jeffrey Coombs to kind of burst in and go full on, shut it, you slag! That'd be great. Let's see, man. Just Jeffrey Coombs should be more just any... Like, how has he not appeared on Doctor Who? Like,
yeah,
we've had Mark Shepard. How have we not had Jeffrey Coombs?
True. Yeah, Mark Shepard, another one of those people that for a time was in everything. Anyway, back to the point here. Yeah, this is no Andorian incident, so it's going below that.
I've watched the Andorian incident, and you, sir, are no Andorian incident.
Let's exactly.
Now we have... Oh,
someone was talking to me about Shran just today. That's what I've become.
Oh, dear. Okay. Then we have, at number 82, we have Minefield. And I feel Minefield is better.
Yeah, well, I should, as a person who loves horror, I should prefer for Vulcan zombies over this. I prefer the tension of you're impaled by a mine on the outside of a ship. You will definitely die first, but a lot of people are going to die if you fuck this up, you know?
And, that. You know, I like the character interaction between Reed and Archer.
Yes.
Like,
yeah.
Like, I feel any time where in Enterprise, Scott Bakula gets the Scott Bakula, definitely always kind of knocks it up. And I feel like, I don't know if it's we don't keep watching the right episodes of Enterprise, is that we don't get a lot of chances for Scott Bakula to cook, because he's such an effortlessly charming actor.
He is. That's my biggest fear with season three, that Scott Bakula will be given nothing, that he'll be given diet Jack Bauer to be instead of his normal charming self.
Yeah, because the short back and sides grumpy Y2K haircut doesn't help.
No. He needs to look like an Alan Davis character.
He just basically needs to look how he does in Quantum Leap.
I think I've found a potential spot here.
Okay.
In 88, we have The Changeling, where Kirk gets a metal sun. And above it, 87, we've got Space Seed, which, introduces us to Khan. And, like, Space Seed, despite being Khan's introduction, got this low because it's not great, but it's a legendary episode.
I feel the best moment of the episode is when Khan pulls a scalpel on Bones. And Bones' response was, look, if you're going to do it, you do it here, do it right.
Damn straight.
Now, don't
Khan's
stab your
professional.
Don't stab your doctor.
Yeah. So I think it might be that it's better than Changeling, worse than Space Seed.
Yeah, like the Changeling, it was good. I remember the Changeling. I don't know. Let's see. What's below? I don't know. Because we've got Beyond the Farthest Star.
Oh, yeah.
And I feel like that
hit the point of going the best cosmic horror we've covered already compared to these.
I don't know. I definitely think in terms of cosmic horror, Beyond the Farthest Star might be up there, because it really has that sense of isolation. It really sells like the sheer scale and isolation. And I think that's actually just another thing I think the animated series does, because you always get these huge wide shots of like space, a desolate planet, and then you just have our characters be tiny dots because that's easier to animate. And it just helps make the universe just so desolate, in the same way that a quarry in Wales can stand in for every single space planet in Blake 7.
Wow.
Yeah. Hashtag Blake's boys.
No. Hashtag no Blake's boys.
Hashtag say yes to Blake's boys.
Okay, another zombie-ish thing is Let Sleeping Borg Lie from Prodigy.
That, and then we have the Broken Circle. And I feel like with Let Sleeping Borg Lie, it gives us a different take on the Borg, where the horror isn't they're going to forcefully assimilate you. It's that because how the Borg exists is so very similar to how your own species work, that you might almost want to be assimilated because it's familiar.
Yeah, Zero being kind of tempted.
Yeah, and I feel like that's an interesting way to look at the Borg, and to look at the horror of the Borg.
Seeing justice, as fun as justice is, it's not good.
No, but and there's an equal amount of running around.
There is. Yeah, I mean, not so much being chased, but you know,
it's just awkward.
Respectfully, be around the fuck planet.
It's awkward fun running.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think this might be better than Justice just has a very abrupt ending.
It does. Yeah.
So. You know what? Okay. I'm gonna say that this is better than Justice.
Cool. So our new number 95 is, I feel kind of bad for the person I was talking to about. I was saying, oh yeah, I'm off shortly to record the Star Trek podcast. So I was saying about Enterprise and, oh God, theme tune for season 3 and Yay Shran and all that. And he was like, oh yeah, the zombie one. I like that. So, well, I'm sorry, Ricky, if you're hearing this. It's 95 out of 114.
They can't all be winners.
Yeah, but you are for making it through this episode.
True.
That's it for us. We've had a lot of fun with cosmic horror, and we're going to stick with the theme a little, as we're going to have one of our diversion episodes. And next time, we're going to be talking about some science fiction cosmic horror in a show I've never seen before called Space 1999. Yeah, it's not Blake 7. And that's one of the only reasons I've said yes.
This is the this was the compromise.
It was. Yes.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, you can find us on Blue Sky at casualtrek.bsky.social. You can also throw us a little bit of money on our Ko-fi, which is ko-fi.com/casualtrek, and suggest a theme, a character, a specific episode that you like or that you want to hear us endure, and we will build an episode for show entirely around it. Miles, where can folks find you?
They can find me on my live journal at mareedlabato.wordpress.com, which is about as desolate as the expanse right now, but it's been a... Life is life. It's been a time. You can find me on milesweedlabato.bluesky.social. We also have our Casual Trek Blue Sky account at casualtrek.bsky.social. I am not as prevalent on them as I should, but you know, I'm trying to wean myself off social media so much. And Twitter is currently, I'm working on it, but Twitter is also glitchy as fuck.
Oh, wow.
Right now, so it's just difficult to use Twitter in and of itself.
Good.
Unless you clearly pay for Twitter so you can complain about minorities in Star Wars or something.
Yeah.
Or how Discovery is inherently the worst TV show ever.
Of course.
It isn't. Star Maidens exists.
Okay.
See, Charlie, you should be glad I'm not asking for us to do a Star Maidens podcast, because Star Maidens is a 70s English-German co-production about a corrupt matriarchal dystopian planet where women rule and men are the secondary class. Almost the reverse of our own gender politics, and some men, one of whom is played by Blake from Blake 7, with a fantastic 70s perm, escape to present-day Earth with the Star Maidens in hot pursuit.
Wow. Okay.
So, yeah. Emma should thank me for never suggesting Star Maidens.
Of course. Right.
And where can we find you?
Yeah, so I am also on Blue Sky. I'm skyshark.bsky.social. I'm also writing quite a bit at the moment on Who Dares Rolls. After a very fun UK Games Expo, I have a series of articles that I'm gradually drip-feeding there. So yeah, that's where to check out my stuff currently. With that, go do a Starfleet. Try not to consider the vast expanse of space and your obsolescence in it. Not too much, at least.
Go have a jelly baby and say no to Trillium.
You have been listening to Casual Trek, a Nerd and Tie podcast, presented by Charlie Etheridge Nunn and Miles Reed Labato. Music by Alfred Etheridge Nunn. Star Trek by Paramount. Not us. Not yet.